Now, my panel this morning, Kieran Mulvey is Chairman of Sport Ireland. Alice Leahy is Director of Services of the Alice Leahy Trust. Nicholas Kearns is former President of the High Court. Christina Finn is a political correspondent with the Journal.ie. And Grainne Healy is a public affairs consultant. And good morning, and you're all very welcome. And if you would put on your headphones for a minute, I want to take a call first. So obviously, all the papers... full of the murder of Liara McKee in Derry on Thursday night today. And Derry native and journalist with the Press Association, Aoife Moore, joins me now. And Aoife, you've been writing about Liara and about Creggan. And you tweeted on Friday, it's hard to put into words the feeling when your mammy tells you not to come home for Easter if you're planning to work. So like most journalists, presumably you want to go to where the story is happening, and particularly if it's something happening in your home place. Your mother was worried for your safety.
Yeah. I mean, like all mammies worry, but the kind of work that I do and the riots that I've covered over the summer and the kind of situation in Derry at the minute, my mum didn't want me to come home. She was worried that me being me would probably go up into the heart of it and something would happen. And I think when Liara was tragically killed, it really spooked her. And I think it spooked all of us who work in journalism. But she was quite afraid, so she told me that I wasn't to come home if I was going to work.
Now, Aoife, you spent your childhood in Creggan. Describe the Creggan to us.
Yeah, so it's the biggest housing estate in Derry. I think my family were one of the first to move into it in the late 1950s. It's 99% Catholic, I would say, and it has been. And it is an area of like rampant inequality. There's a lot of poverty in Creggan, and always has been. There's massive inequality. There's a lot of issues with, you know, neglect and mental health. And it's been very much borne the brunt, really, of the troubles and the troubles in Derry. A lot of the major flashpoints were in Creggan. A lot of people lost their lives there in the trouble. And the people of Creggan are very tight-knit community because of that. They've kind of overcome so much together that it's very much everybody knows everyone and everyone's kind of raised in everyone else's houses. It's that kind of community.
And you've written, I know, about the lack of opportunity that kind of infects all the black spots of the Troubles. But I suppose what we're learning about Creggan now is that, in a way, is it an environment where young people are ripe for being radicalised, are ripe to go out causing trouble on the street, being egged on into that?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the same everywhere. Like, this kind of thing isn't happening in rich areas. These are young people who have a serious lack of opportunity. Derry, in general, has been neglected for years in terms of infrastructure and opportunity and jobs. And young people who have any opportunity, like myself, go away for university. They go away to work. And this is a symptom of what happens. These young people have not been offered any real opportunity. And these are the kinds of people that these dissident groups target, people who feel that they have nothing else. They're kind of, they offer them a sense of, you know, a sense of being part of something, a sense of community. These are kind of vulnerable kids who want to be part of something. And this is kind of the perfect hunting ground, for lack of a better word, for these groups to kind of target young, vulnerable, mostly young men, to get them into this kind of trouble.
And Aoife, is there a sense up there now? There definitely seems to be a sense in general. Is there a sense in Creggan now, after the murder of Liara, is there any sense this could be a turning point, that people are saying enough of this?
Absolutely. I mean, the support for dissident republicanism in Derry has always been small in the last few years, but there may have been at times a sense of ambivalence. I mean, people just ignored it. But now, since Liara's murder, the people of Derry have, in what I've seen, absolutely had enough. I mean, the graffiti in Creggan, the pro-IRA graffiti in Creggan has been part and parcel of Creggan since I can remember. And it was painted over on Friday, which is a huge, huge thing. I mean, there's plenty of gable walls in Creggan that have pro-IRA graffiti. So to see that painted over was a huge marker for me that things are changing. And then last night, someone sprayed not in our name on Free Dairy Corner. So there's definitely a sense, especially with young people, that they're not going to stand for this anymore. People are really, really up in arms. The people of Craigan especially are devastated about what happened. I mean, Derry has turned such a corner in the last 10, 15 years even, that to have this happen on the streets again is just such a blow for the people who are working so hard to try and get past our worst past.
Okay, Aoife Moore, thank you very much for joining us this morning and happy Easter.
Thanks.
Now, to the panel. Gráinne, there's so much in the papers today about Lyra herself as well. You did pick out a story, Lyra, from the Sunday Business Post. Lyra McKee's life was a gift to anyone who knew her.
Yeah, this is a lovely personal piece, and again, there have been a lot of people who knew her personally, and their pieces are just, you know, it would do people good to sit down and read these this morning, because oftentimes we hear of people, you know, who have been killed in the dreadful troubles that we've had, but they become statistics. And there is a sense, as your interviewer said there a moment ago, that this is a game changer. And I think when you read the story of this woman and her life, she was only 29, she wasn't even 30. And this one in particular talks about her as a gift, her you know, her sense of humour. She was an advocate in particular for young people in Northern Ireland, where, for example, marriage equality still is not legal there. Herself and her partner, Sarah, who again spoke beautifully yesterday, about her loss and that hoping that it would not be in vain. So this idea of this young couple who've recently moved to Derry, making it their city, their life, and Lyra's own piece, her piece that she wrote that was made into a short film, again, for people to have a look at that, this letter to my 14-year-old self, where ironically in it, she ends it by saying, as a young gay person, you know, it gets better if you live long enough. And the tragedy is that she hasn't lived long enough to be able to see some of the changes for some of the advocacy. And her journalism also was all about looking at the vulnerable. She had done work in particular about the high rates of suicide amongst young people living in places like Craigan. And that idea that, you know, there are many young people who, if they had enough luck and enough privilege, they've gone off elsewhere to be educated, to get jobs. But those who haven't had that are pretty much stuck. And I think that's what we're seeing in terms of the emerging chaos in the political vacuum that is in Northern Ireland without the Stormont Assembly up and running.
Nicholas Kearns, on this notion of a game changer, you were looking at the Sunday Times page one, Sarah Raleigh sparks outrage on social media. People really are furious and disgusted, aren't they?
Well, can I just begin by obviously expressing deep regret for Lyra and her family in the terrible situation that has occurred. Yes, I mean, I think it will be a game changer, because I really feel there can't be a person in Ireland who wants us to go back to the situation we endured during the Troubles. I understand the kind of situation of social problems and so on as background, but you could say the same thing in England about knife crime, that there is a background there which, if you like, where young people have no outlet, that they can turn to very destructive patterns of behaviour. But this was an outrageous, despicable and cowardly act. The fact, well, obviously, while two young people have been apprehended, they enjoy a presumption of innocence until such time as all the facts are known and all the evidence is collected. But you know, this gathering seems to have grown because MTV cameras were on the location.
There seems to be a suggestion that this egged it on. They were putting on a show for the cameras.
And under cover of the, if you like, development of this situation, we now know that a young person from behind a concealed position fired indiscriminately in the direction of PSNI officers and the position where Lyra McKee was standing. No amount of his, if you like, environmental or ambient circumstances can justify that. It was a despicable outrage.
Yeah. And it is apparently a feature of these situations that there will be a gun fired towards the PSNI. Kieran Mulvey, you looked at the Sun, page 5, pathetic cowards Sarah march in Dublin.
Yeah, I think to reflect also what Nicholas has been saying there, first of all, obviously, our sympathy goes out to Lyra's family and her partner, Sarah. But this idea that we're allowing on the main street of our city on the commemoration of the Easter Rising that led to our independence, paramilitary groups to parade in battle camouflage uniforms, I think that has to be questioned. I think we have to ask ourselves, are we ourselves tolerant of this display of semi-militarism? There is only one army in Ireland recognised by the state, and that's the Irish Defence Forces, and no other paramilitary group anywhere on our island, but particularly on the main street of our capital city that is so synonymous with a war of independence and the uprising in 1916, should be allowed anywhere near it.
You see, I think the extraordinary thing, I think I read yesterday, that Sarah don't even need a permit to march because it's under a certain number. I'm not sure what the number was. And the police said there was a peaceful demonstration. It passed off without incident, the Gardaí said. And that seemed to be it. Mm. Alice Leahy?
Yeah, I read that too. And I mean, I must say I was shocked to see that display on television last night. But I did see that statement from the guards and I just could not believe it. I mean, at Easter time, when there is so much happening and so much needs to be done, that this can happen, it just isn't good enough.
Yeah, absolutely.
I might add that new IRA would be a proscribed organisation under the Offences Against the State Act. I feel certain and I hope the guards will look very closely at that event in Dublin yesterday with a view to considering if further action can be taken.
But these rallies have been taking place. I think it's notable that they're on the front covers, front pages today, but these sort of rallies by these Republican groups have been taking place on O'Connell Street for years. I've covered them, you know, around Easter time. They're a regular feature, but I think people obviously, because of the circumstances and the tragedy that happened there up in Derry, it really has, I suppose, sparked everyone's attention. Perhaps people weren't aware that this was actually taking place for the last number of years. And as you said, I think people, rightly so, have questions asked about permits and the rest, because, as you said, the Gardaí said there was no issue yesterday. But something easily could have been sparked on O'Connell Street yesterday, particularly because of the high emotions around Lear's death.
Yeah, and you'd have to say it took some gall for them to go out there yesterday, didn't it? Kieran Mulvey, you were looking at Éilis O'Hanlon in the Sunday Indo as well, am I right? Lyra's death exposes the lie that IRA violence was ever justified.
Yeah, but the Irish Independence forced separate articles on this, but apart from the article mentioned, Jean Kerrigan, I think, in page 28, A Shot from the Past. I think he, if I may quote, I think he really summarises it. He said, first they killed her, then they lied about it. They would cancel Monday's 1916 commemoration, they said, as a mark of respect for the tragic and accidental killing of Lyra McGee. Two lies. It wasn't accidental. They were aiming specifically at Lyra McGee, just as all humans in our vicinity. I mean, anyone who takes a firearm in their possession potentially are going to use it. And this is an illegal firearm and in a crowded space. We have had enough history of appalling atrocities in Derry over the years, and I don't need to go back into those. The Savile inquiry and other issues are going on still. But here is a case of two young people who allegedly have been arrested now and may allegedly have issues to address on this. They're 18 and 19. She was 29. The Good Friday Agreement is only 21 years old. I mean, we have a real problem here now. But it's not just on, I would suggest, on what is euphemistically called the nationalist side. There are issues also in the loyalist side, in similar deprived areas where paramilitarism or organised crime is continuing. And the Good Friday Agreement, we talk about Brexit and the threat to the Good Friday Agreement. There's a bigger threat to the Good Friday Agreement, and that's internally in Northern Ireland, with the political vacuum we have and the lack of priority we are giving to eliminating that vacuum. As much effort should be going into our talks with Brexit as to re-establishing the Northern Ireland Assembly and the Northern Ireland government.
Yeah, I agree with that entirely. There was one member of the public reported as standing in O'Connell Street with their hands up trying to stop the march, and one of the organisers then stood in front of that person and directed the march around them. I have a sense that if more people knew that that march was going to happen, we would have seen an awful lot more people in there with their hands up. But that, of course, may lead to clashes. So there is something about, you know, what is there to do to stop these displays? But also the question that Kieran raises is a really good one. You know, we talk about the radicalisation of young people. You know, for these people who are under 21 or who were babies when the ceasefire and the agreement was signed, what is it that is happening that they would have this view that they are unfree, that this is a country that doesn't look after their needs? So while I take Nicholas's point that nothing excuses the murder of this young woman, there are people who are getting back into a mindset that is giving them permission to be part of this kind of activity. And that is happening in the vacuum because there is not a political... I mean, I heard all the political leaders. They came together. They made a strong statement the other day. But the real statement would be for them to say, and the date for the re-establishment of the Stormont Assembly is fill in that gap.
OK. Does anyone think that there's another side to... OK, it's terrible that these young people are becoming radicalised and you'd worry for that generation. Is there another side to this generation that have just seen this? And I wonder if what's different this time is you have a generation who are quite politicised in lots of ways. They've overthrown a lot of the way we talk about things and think about things in terms of from everything from sexuality to lots of other stuff. And are they now turning their gaze on this and the social media gaze is going at it and they're waking up to it and going, hang on a minute, and they won't accept it. They won't accept it in a way that it was in the past. Does anyone think that there's something happening there?
In terms of this?
Yeah.
Yes, I think so. I think the level of outrage, and as the woman on the phone was saying, you know, that altering of the graffiti, that is very, very powerful. And that is about people who maybe have felt silenced, who maybe have felt, oh, well, it's only a small member of the small grouping of the community. I think there has been a game changer. And social media has allowed people to express that anger. There was a spontaneous gathering in Stephen's Green the other day, shortly after the news of her death. So social media allows that very immediate public widespread response. And I think that that is a good thing, but it needs to push the politicians to do the right thing.
I suppose it's the balancing act between the younger people that, as you said, are politicised, but then also casting your gaze over at the younger people, as you said, that feel disenfranchised. I think the stalemate between the talks up in Stormont has definitely contributed in terms of, you know, the Good Friday Agreement to a degree has been neglected in terms of just letting things go as they are. I think someone said that we're walking sleeplessly back into perhaps this sparking again. And, you know, you have these ceasefire babies, I suppose, as Lyra described it, perhaps looking for a cause. And if you've been up in the north in the last number of months or the last year when there has been, you know, that vacuum of power, you'll see the graffiti of, you know, the Irish Language Act being denied to a certain sect of society. And in that way, it causes that them versus us again. And it's a younger generation that have never had that cause. They've only heard about it from their parents and from their grandparents, but feel that they can latch onto it as something that's being denied from
them. It's something kind of poppy that they can grasp. Okay. And listen, by the way, I am very conscious that there are a lot of people have lost their lives in Sri Lanka, and we will be talking about that in a while on the show as well. Now, Kieran Mulvey, seeing as you're here, the FAI trundles on and on. I don't want to get too into the details of the story on the front of the Sunday Times. You were looking at the story inside as well, also by Mark Tai, why Delaney got the red card. Your thoughts at this point?
My thoughts at this point is this is a story that's not going to go away. It's going to a story that keeps giving, I think. And I think that continuous release of information, as I said at the Oireachtas Committee, the continual drip feed of this is going to create terrible difficulties for those of us who are committed to reforming the FAI and bringing good corporate governance to it.
You found out at the committee about the, is it called a H4?
About the auditors. An hour before the committee hearing, I was informed by our own legal advisors that this form had been put up on the CRO website.
You must have been livid, were you?
Well, livid is hardly the word to describe it, but if I had the three or four people I'd met in the room with me, I think they'd be claiming some kind of injury at this stage. Because we're going into an Oireachtas committee. John Tracy and I had to ring the chairman of the committee to inform of this before we went in at all for two reasons. Number one, it's information that came to our attention that was extremely material. But secondly, having received it, it would have wholly been inappropriate to withhold it from the chairman and the members of the Oireachtas committee. That would have been grossly irresponsible and disrespectful. It totally changed the nature of that hearing altogether. That here was further information the committee was getting, and we getting, that people were aware of and should have told us.
Which suggests they're learning nothing, are they? There's no sense of you know, we're sorry and now we're going to cooperate.
Well, I think after our further engagement with them, they're in no doubt where we stand now.
So did you know the Mail on Sunday today, FAI under investigation over second set of accounts? Did you know about that?
Well, I would assume that was beginning to happen when the honorary treasurer at the Oireachtas committee said they hadn't one account, but on mature recollection found out they had 24 accounts.
Yeah, no, that's bank accounts. This seems to suggest a second set of actual accounts.
Well, it would appear to give credence. No, I wasn't aware. I'm not on the board of the FAI. I'm not the banker to the FAI.
Don't know, like, this is under investigation. You're not even aware of some of the stuff that's potentially being investigated at this stage.
Well, I'd be aware of some of it in confidence that I would be aware that Mazars are undertaking. And this particular item, my understanding and from what I read, was signposted. The nature of the payments, the circumstances of the payment, I'm not aware of and would be inappropriate for me to speculate upon. But we're hoping to meet with the FAI again later this week. We also are trying.
Do you think are they coming clean with you at this point, Kieran?
Well, I think they're beginning to come clean with us.
Only
but
beginning.
I don't think they know themselves fully the nature of the transactions that have taken place in the FAI in the last 4 or 5 years. I think that's the difficulty. We're finding difficulty. We put out a procurement for auditors to assist us in the exercise in reviewing the finances of the FAI. We got no response from any firm of auditors in the country. Now, isn't that saying something?
The auditing firm.
As I said the other day, in the Oireachtas, who audits the auditors? And at this stage, I'd say most reputable firms, and they're all reputable, I have no reason to think otherwise, don't want to put themselves into this scenario for reputational and other reasons.
Alice Leahy, you're a huge sports fan, aren't you? What do you make of all this?
I love sport. I think it's shocking what's going on. I think it is appalling. My concern would be, I'm thinking of the small clubs throughout the country, in towns and villages, and I'm a great believer in sport. It helps young people. If you're talking about young people getting involved in trouble, but if you're people involved in sport, in boxing and soccer and rugby and, of course, GAA, it will help them to work as a team and to know what it's like. And will those struggling soccer clubs now, will they get any money? And I think if you have leaders who are working very hard, I know, and if there's no money there now to support them, are all those young people going to lose out? And that's something I think we have to be careful of. You know, can the Sports Council make sure that money is available to those groups. But I think
what do you think, Alice, of the way this is? Because you obviously you run a charity,
we
a trust, and I'm sure you have to be very careful about making sure that everything is above board. What do you think of the way this is all panning out?
I just can't believe it. It's so bad. Well, mind you, the way I see so many other things, I believe how things happen. But we're a very small agency. We have a wonderful board of directors. They sit down every month. They get our financial statements from our treasurer. The accountants come in every year. Now, the forensic, they go through everything. And we even were getting donations of bread to give people nice fresh brown bread. I won't say which was, but one of Dublin's best known bakers. And we had to ask them how much would that bread cost so that we could tell our accountant. And they come in and they go through everything. And and agencies who are getting, we don't get money from the state. People are very good to us. Our accounts have been audited from day one, from 1975. But I think it raises questions about the board members. They should be asking questions. They should be getting this information. And if it wouldn't have got to that stage. I think it's shocking.
And do you think the board should all go at this point?
I think if they lose everyone, the easiest thing would be to say get rid of a lot of them. But I think in getting rid of a lot of them, are you going to lose out on some of what's been happening and will you get the information? So,
Grainne, do you think they should all go?
Yeah, I think they should all go immediately. I think the key thing here is that the organisation can move back into a space where they will regain the sporting public's confidence, the minister's confidence, the government's confidence. And, as Alice is saying, in smaller NGOs that I would work with, the level of governance and compliance that is expected, whether you're on the FAI or in a local community organisation. And I suppose the thing about it is that the board has to be, they are the ones who lead the organisation. The CEO's role is to implement the vision and the mission, but it is the board who keep control and watch. And when you lose that, as it seems to me, that is what has happened, given that so many of the board didn't seem to know what was actually going on. So I would have a sense that a new board needs to be put in place.
Nicholas Kearns, do we need a new board?
Well, one of the seven labours of Hercules was to clean out the Augean stables, as you may recall, and he attempted and succeeded in doing that by diverting a river through the stables to clean everything out. Until these inquiries are complete, I just don't know what's going to happen. You couldn't repose confidence in an organisation with the amount of governance issues confronting the FAI at the moment. I'm sorry to say it, because Ireland needs to feel pride in its soccer team and in its management, and this is a dreadful situation for a sports follower or a supporter of the game or sport generally in Ireland to see unravelling as it has.
Kieran, the board have all said they'll go, but not yet. There's a big feeling they should just go now.
Yeah, and I can understand the justifiable anger and concern about this that has been expressed publicly and on the panel. I've always been, for a long time, in the business of negotiation. I need to negotiate with somebody to ensure the corporate and financial and reporting structures and governance are in place. As I said before, I can't negotiate with a postbox that just receives letters from Sport Ireland. I think the statement they've made is helpful. But in Sport Ireland, we need to be able to deal with a representative group of people at management level who have authority, responsibility, and have to take responsibility for what has emerged and what will be known, so that we, with them, can change the ethos, the culture, the organisation, the financial control, the governance, and the reporting arrangements within FAI. And I understand it will be, Nicholas. I'm not suggesting I'm Hercules in this regard, but the Board of Sport Ireland is very clear on this. The FAI has to be totally reformed at its senior management level, and people within that organisation at other levels within it need to come to the fore as a new management team and officer board.
Can I ask you, did Sport Ireland miss something here up to recently? Mm-hmm. Because you look, for example, in the sports section of the of the Sunday Independent today, they have an ex-PRO for the GAA. And he says that the idea of the CEO of an organisation going around visiting all these clubs is ridiculous in the first place. The fact that he's out dispensing largesse and everything. Was there not some class of any alarm bells going off at the FAIFE before Mark Tighe had the story 3 weeks ago?
There wouldn't be, in the sense that our responsibility in regard to sports funding is for the quantum of money we give to the organisations. That's our obligation to ensure that's appropriately spent for the endeavours and the submissions made to us, and we have agreed to do that. The issue of individual management of sport organisations under company law and under charity regulation is fundamentally a matter for those organisations themselves. They have obligations legally and otherwise under those arrangements.
Not your problem.
We're not a regulatory authority.
Okay.
But that
Did you have your own suspicions about the FAI and governance?
Well, we always understood they had cash flow problems. They came to us that. But that's not unusual in organisations that have a large level of international commitments and where international bodies are slow in giving money to these organisations. That was the situation that arose in Cricket Ireland. And I'd just like to say, Cricket Ireland came into us. The chief executive came into us. He broke no arrangements in regard to us. He did exactly what we expected the FAI to have done when that emerged. And we have engaged with them positively over the last number of months. There's one or two things we would have wished they had done differently. But they were waiting for a major financial commitment from the International Cricket Council that didn't come in time. It has subsequently come in. And what you have to remember about Cricket Ireland is they have to also represent the country in men and women's teams. Now that we're a T20 nation, which is an extraordinary achievement in cricket, we're in the top 10 of the world. So that isn't different. There is a similarity of about a transaction. But we were at least informed about that. We may have given them advice as to whether it should have been done that way or not, but we were informed.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, looking at where to go, I would love to see the new board being made up. I'd love to see a gender balance on it. I'd love to see some of the local community groups, along with the skill set that a board requires. But certainly the idea of getting rid of a cohort of people, again, without passing aspersions, they need to go, they will go. I accept Ciarán's point about in doing the mop-up, you need to have somebody to negotiate with. I do accept that. But I think the plan for the new board has got to be a really good plan that will allow all of us, you know, not to be ashamed of our young female sports persons changing
CEO,
their jackets.
There were some people suggesting a CEO, maybe perhaps a woman might be way to go, but who knows. But it's interesting, I think Niall Quinn was saying.
No, we have an interim CEO who is a woman right now.
That's right. Yeah,
exactly. No, we have other sports organisations with excellent CEOs.
Yes.
And it is a feature that Sport Ireland has been developing over the number of years. The importance of gender balance on boards, the importance of gender balance within top echelons of the management. And they're coming through very, very strongly in recent years.
But I think regardless of who takes over, who heads the reforms, I think there has been a lot of negative commentary about how bad this has gotten. And, you know, anyone watching that Oireachtas committee would have been holding their head in their hands about how that was conducted. But I think, you know, there is an opportunity here. Niall Quinn was in at Leinster House briefing politicians during the week about the opportunity that is here now to actually clean house, to bring in proper reforms, to ensure that people in the League of Ireland, football players, get the opportunities that they need rather than shipping players off to the UK for their future. And I do think, you know, the pressure that's been ratcheted up on this is welcome, and I really would hope that it's not just going to fall off the front pages and not be followed up on. I really do hope, I think, and most people would, that reforms are on the way for that organisation.
Yeah, I don't think it's going away anytime soon. Welcome back. Our Easter Sunday panel still with us. Gráinne Healy, Christina Finn, Nicholas Kearns, Alice Leahy and Ciarán Mulvey. And I want to talk about compo culture. Now, Nicholas, you're kind of a player in this, and you picked out, there's an interview with Charlie Flanagan in the Sunday Business Post today, and he's quite critical of lawyers in it. Now infamously said last week that you'd need to be a flat earther to think that there is not a compo culture in Ireland. So what's Charlie Flanagan saying today? Is it good or bad from your point of view?
Well, I suppose, first of all, we have to recognise that there is a problem. And when the Personal Injury Commission compiled its report and submitted it last September, everybody on that commission recognised there was a significant problem in Ireland where compensation and awards for whiplash and soft tissue injuries are running at 4.5 times the level in the UK, top of European comparators.
On that, can I interrupt you for a second, Nicholas, and you can confirm to me that this is all accurate. Stephen Collins had an extraordinary piece in the Irish Times during the week. So you get a minor hand injury where there's no tearing of the ligament, and often no movement is lost. There may be tenderness and slight swelling, which is substantially recovered, and you are in line for £19,000 to £36,000. A mild forearm or elbow injury, similar, tenderness, slight swelling, which is gone, essentially, £14,000 to £33,000. For a thumb, £21,000. If you get partial tears to a ligament, it's £40,000. And if the ligament are actually torn, you get £50,000. Is that how it is?
Well, that's what the Book of Quantum that PIAB have says. And, of course, it's based on court awards and drawn from that source. So I read the piece, Stephen Collins' piece. I think the fact that a journalist of such high repute is entering into the debate shows the traction now that this problem is having with the public generally.
And a lot of people blaming judges.
So it would appear.
Okay, you're staying judicial on that one.
So it would appear. The question is now, instead of a blame game, what are we going to do about it? And the interview, Francesca Cummins' interview with Minister Flanagan gives some idea of what's going to happen and what isn't going to happen. One of our recommendations in the Personal Injury Commission was that we should have a Garda fraud dedicated Garda fraud investigation unit. He's come out against that. Now that's a bit of a worry because the driver for fraudulent and exaggerated claims is the fact that our awards and settlements are so high in Ireland.
Secondly, and you're saying this is fraud? A lot of these cases
some of them.
Facilitated by our learned friends?
No, I'm not saying that. In fact, I would go in the opposite direction on that. In recent times, we have seen more and more reports of judges revealing in a court case their views that a claim is either grossly exaggerated or fraudulent.
Are solicitors and barristers colluding in these fraudulent cases?
I couldn't say that without solid evidence.
Flanagan is quite critical of the legal profession today, isn't he?
Well, there are people who can hinder and people who can help in the current situation. Rather than saying that the Law Society or the Bar Council are hindering, I'm looking to them to help make a solution to this. This is not an unfixable problem. I'm also looking to the insurance industry to step forward and do their part. If they could bring themselves to give a clear commitment that if the Judicial Council issues guidelines which will recalibrate and make awards of damages in this area in particular more consistent, if they could come forward to say there will be a proportionate reduction in premiums, if this happens, that would be a step in the right direction. Bear this in mind, there were representatives of both professions, both branches of the legal profession, on the commission. They supported the recommendations for judicial guidelines that the judiciary be asked to themselves indicate guidelines for, particularly for the circuit court and district court, as to what appropriate sums of compensation for these minor soft tissue and whiplash injuries should be. I want to stress the Court of Appeal in dealing with the larger cases has done a great deal of work in the last 2 years in readjusting and recalibrating damages downwards for the more serious injuries. But the Court of Appeal can't reach down to the Circuit Court because Circuit Appeals, if somebody gives too much, if a judge gives too much, the appeal can only go to the High Court. It can't go any further.
Okay, so that's why we need.
I think anyone listening at home probably has experience of getting their renewal car insurance, or there's the smaller businesses that have been nearly priced out of business in the play group areas. But while Charlie Flanagan is coming out quite strong in the Sunday Business Post, calling insurers, that's saying that they're profiteering, you know, this discussion has been going on for years within government. Owen Murphy headed up a report into motor insurance costs, and then it moved on to Michael Darcy, who has said that he will push for a referendum if the judiciary does not counter on high damages. And now we have Charlie Flanagan putting the foot down on it. But as was pointed out, that this has been a discussion that's been going on for ages. Reports have been coming out and little or nothing has happened, yet prices continue to go up. And I think it's interesting that Charlie Flanagan has stepped away from this Garda fraud unit, as you're stating there, because that was one of the key recommendations coming out of one of the government reports, that this was done in the UK. The insurance companies were happy to contribute towards it. And this just seems to be a non-runner.
As I understand it, the insurance companies are spending a lot of money themselves now on private investigators and everything, aren't they? And taking a more proactive approach. Go on, you, Healy.
Yeah, I think the public's view of something needs to be done about this has been a view for a long time. But in particular, one of the sectors that I would do a lot of work is in the childcare sector. And we have literally dozens of local community childcare centres who are either going to be unable to continue to provide their service because their insurance has gone up tenfold, tenfold. Now, I accept when something happens to a child and they make a claim, it is probably in the higher ends if it is a serious claim. But the fact that these local groups are going to be unable to provide the services, what's happening at the moment is they're unable to pay decent salaries because their insurance premiums are actually soaking up the money that they're taking in the door. So this is a real problem that is having real impact, not just on our car insurance, but literally on those kind of services that are underpinning allowing people to go to work, allowing people to go back to training and education. So it is an urgent issue.
Kieran Mulvey.
Yeah, I think, as Nicholas said, judges have become far more proactive, I think, in terms of the reports that have been made, certainly in the media. What I find extraordinary is that, number one, a lot of these claims that have been found to be fraudulent seem to be orchestrated as a racket. The individuals involved seem to be multiple claimants in the past successfully. And the third thing is, there's no respect for perjury anymore. We have no law of perjury. I know there's one being drafted in the Senate.
There is a common law
against
perjury.
Common law, I think,
that Minister Flanagan had indicated he would bring forward a
that
statutory.
That would be important because
so essentially the reality of it is, if you're caught out in the situation, your case is thrown out, slap in the wrist, and that's it. So there's no downside for these people of giving it a go then.
No, they walk out of court. Everybody says goodbye. I presume solicitors get paid, barristers get paid, and
go off and organise their next.
They might turn up again somewhere in another part of the country with driving around a roundabout, four in a car, and the same four individuals. Somebody suddenly bumps into them that they claim they don't know, and then we find out they're a relative or a cousin.
Okay, I want to talk about Tune Guys before 12. Alice Lee, you were looking at some of this. Elaine Byrne has a piece in the Sunday Business Post. After the trauma of Tuam, the lingering silence brings more pain.
Yeah, there's lots in the papers today. The Sunday Business Post, the Indo, and the Sunday Times. And I suppose I was struck by the piece, first by Michael Brennan, where Anne Rabbit said there has to be a dose of reality and realism in all of this, and children living in hubs feel like prisoners, and politicians will go down in history. And I suppose
now,
I am looking at
this is interesting, because we have Leo Varadkar talking again this week about dark chapters in our history at the same time as that report came out about family hubs. And what Anne Rabbit is saying is that we don't have 13 million to start digging up.
Yeah, so we spend it on the children of today.
Yeah. What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, I've been looking at this for a long time, because in the early days of our work, we met women who were lost in a haze of psychiatric medication and alcohol to blot out the pain of living where they may have had a baby that died or maybe was not with them, and they couldn't talk about it because it was a sin or it was wrong and they had the baby outside of marriage. And I can still see those women. And I would also have met children of some of those women who are hurting. But now we are looking at children in hubs. And while the religious were given money by the state to look after those poor women, the state is now offloading their responsibility in the area of housing families and young children. And large sums of money are being given to NGOs to provide that service. Now, the recent report from the Ombudsman, there were people who weren't too happy with that report because they felt it wasn't balanced. And officials and different people are struggling to provide accommodation. And there is no accommodation there. But looking at those children growing up in those hubs, I think history will judge us to maybe not having moved on. And I think I can understand maybe why Anne Rabbit would have said that. But then in all the articles, and Justine McCarthy is a very good bit, Elaine Byrne and Maeve Sheehan, they are all looking at the humanity of these women now who are searching, wondering where their babies are buried. And they are entitled to know because they've lived with the pain of that for years. And there are people who do know. They have to know. I mean, it was in the Sunday Business Post too, where they said, or it was, well, it is in all the papers, which is wonderful, mm-hmm. but there must be people in the councils. And I think Catherine Zappone has said people must come out and speak up and they can't hide the truth. But I think that question also should be diverted to government and to local authorities because there are people in there who must know the truth.
And I think Galway County Council have been called out on this. Christina, you reported a lot on Tuam as this story unfolded. You were down in Tuam. There is a lot today, Elaine Byrne talks about it, about the silence and the silence in Tuam as well.
Exactly, yeah. I think she says that the silence brings more pain and that's exactly it. I travelled down to Tuam when that story first broke and was in Catherine Corliss's kitchen, and it was packed out with international media that had huge interest in the story, and I think it really has latched on to a lot of people. But when I was down there, I did feel that there was some sort of nobody really wanted to talk about it. Like, it really is a difficult subject for, I think, the locals down there, and Catherine Corliss came up against it as well when she tried to continue to ask those questions. But I think now what has to happen is this isn't just, I think as Justine McCarthy has said, like it's not historic abuse. This isn't all just done and dusted. There are still people that are living with the scars of this. I spoke to one man down there, Patrick Joseph Haverty, who lived in Tuam, mother and baby hold, till he was 5 and a half. And his mother came and knocked on that door every week to try and get him back. And she wasn't allowed to take him. So this isn't just about the children that are buried there, that are passed away, or about the mothers that are no longer with us. There are people that continue to have answers about what went on. And I think for the local authorities, and Galway County Council particularly was called out in that report for the lack of information that was provided. You know, under the law at the time, local authorities were meant to submit documentation to the state about inspections and about death certificates. At the time when I was down in Tuam, or even before that, I sought access to National Archive documents. And they were removed from the National Archive documents. They were with the Department of Health. And they even wrote, the state wrote to the local authorities at the time in the 1940s saying that there was a lack of interest in administration of these mother and baby homes. So that could be an answer in terms of why there is a lack of information about where children are buried and the register of those deaths.
This was just allowed
and
to happen.
And universities as well have questions to answer.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Now, I want to circle around for a minute back to the papers. Christina, could you explain to us, for people who haven't been following it, the row between Pat Spillane and Michael Ring?
Well, Pat Spillane was on RT and apparently giving out about the government's, I suppose, work they've been doing on redeveloping rural Ireland. And he was very critical, I suppose, of what he said was, you know, the jobs was needed and there should be more people focused. And apparently Michael Ring has been bringing around some of the papers to give his view and saying that he should have been asked on to speak about rural Ireland, given that he is the Minister for Rural Development. And he called Spillane's words, I suppose, cynical, and challenged him on the salary that he was paying and saying that the real, I suppose, what Spillane was trying to say is rural Ireland is dying a death and little or nothing's been done about it.
And what Michael Ring was saying was that Pat Spillane is more concerned about the fact that he didn't get his contract renewed for his job as an ambassador for Rural Ireland. And in fairness, Pat Spillane is a great, passionate ambassador for Rural Ireland. Kieran Mulvey, I see a role for you here. Do you think you would get involved and sort this out and this unseemly spat?
Well, no, I like Michael Ring. I've worked with Michael Ring in the past. I think he's an excellent minister and an excellent politician. And I'm originally from Roscommon, so I have deep respect for anybody who represents rural Ireland and tries to promote rural Ireland, because our towns, our small towns, are dying on their feet and we need to regenerate them. We need to create the potential of employment and tourism, as Owen was talking about there. We have marvellous... I know Pat obviously has a tremendous footballing record, and he's from a county that calls itself the Kingdom, which probably would indicate they have a superior view.
I come from a county
that had the last King of Ireland, who was wonderful, except he lost out to the Normans, and Queen Maeve. So, you know, I think we have better entitlement to be called the Kingdom than Kerry does, but... this, I think, there's a tension here, and you know, it's probably Michael has had a difficult, and I know this, of establishing this ministry. It was a new ministry. It was a ministry with a particular focus. I regret there's a falling out between them, as you would.
Because Pat Spillane would say he was very helpful to Michael in establishing that job,
and I have no doubt about that. But obviously, the term of office came to an end. That happens to us all. And we go into the sun, bright sun of Kerry and Killarney and its surrounds, or myself on my occasional visit.
Kieran Mulvey, you'll always find another gig, I think.
I wrote it from this one.
Okay, Alice.
Well, I come from the Premier County. And, I mean, it's interesting because they are two passionate men. And I think if it was two women, they'd say we were emotional.
A cat fight, I think it would be called.
Yeah, they would. And I'm glad poor old Ryan, he didn't have the two of them on, because can you just imagine what would have happened? I think it is important, but I think they're two grown men and they should sit down around the table rather and kind of come on and say, yes, we do need to work for rural Ireland. And there is that wonderful politician, he's always on from Roscommon. He's always about rural Ireland, and you've met him at Grand, of course. We won't mention Kerry.
But I do think
they are two passionate men, and there's not any spin in this. I think they're being real, and I think, but they should grow up and sit down and discuss it.
Two men speaking from the heart. Grania, I'll give you the last word on this.
And I just thought, wow, he's getting a real run here. The fact that he was on his own. But I would agree. I think the issue is a serious one.
Yeah.
And I think they both have the same agenda. So let's avoid the civil war politics and get working together on it. Yeah.